Welcome to The Science of Murder. This podcast is here to discuss the intersection of crimes, mostly murder and serial killings, and the science that is used to catch the perpetrators. We are here to shine the spotlight on some of the people responsible for the advances in science and the techniques that were used to catch the murderers. We'll talk about how many notorious serial killers have managed to evade being discovered, as well as how they were ultimately caught and convicted. We'll also discuss times where science, or the people yielding it, failed in their quest to catch a killer. I am here to open up conversation topics that still aren't quite acceptable to the mainstream, but also ground them in my own love of science, scientific techniques, and psychological studies. I know I'm not the only one out here fascinated by the science of murder and true crime, so I want us to find each other and learn together. My name is Lissa, and I'll be your host for the discussions of the science of murder. It's been a heck of a time getting this episode out. I actually wrote this episode over 2 months ago. See, I knew before I even started this podcast that I should absolutely be recording ahead. And yet, I kept letting that slide, and then the last 2 months happened. First, I had technical difficulties that led to me replacing my microphone. Then, I had a hellacious sinus infection, which then led to a couple of visits to the dentist and a couple of tooth extractions. Trust me, I was not up to recording those weeks. Luckily, I was already on medical leave from work for another issue. Then my leave was up and I had to return to work, and trying to figure out how to fit this podcast into my new normal was more difficult than I thought. Fun fact about me, I am terribly OCD. And incredibly detail-oriented, because I also have ADHD. So I am a planner. A list maker. This means that before I had recorded my first episode, I spent a significant amount of time scheduling my time and the podcast episodes out for at least a year. I really didn't want to let multiple weeks pass so early in the podcast, but squirrel. So let's restart this party with this week's discussion. Today, we are following the previous episode's discussion of the evolution of DNA as a forensic tool to discuss the more advanced subject of DNA profiling, specifically the use of familial DNA to catch criminals, and where advances in the science of DNA may be headed. Also, disclaimer, there is at least one individual today that I am unable to discuss without being deeply sarcastic about his stupidity. So, fair warning, less science. In every conceivable manner, the family is our link to the past, bridge to our future. Wallace Haley. The most famous example of this new use of DNA technology was in the case of the Golden State Killer, now known as Joseph James DeAngelo, who actually managed to remain unidentified for 44 years before he was identified in 2018. DeAngelo was actually known by several other nicknames in the press before being dubbed the Golden State Killer by Michelle McNamara in 2011, after the different cases were linked through new DNA technology. Before becoming a serial murderer, DeAngelo began his crime spree as a burglar, known as the Visalia Ransacker in 1974 to 1975. Then, between 1976 and 1979, he was a serial rapist who assaulted around 50 women in Northern California, earning the nickname the East Area Rapist before, again, seemingly going dormant. In reality, he moved down to Southern California in 1979, where he continued his crimes and escalated to murder. In Southern California, DeAngelo killed at least 13 people and became known as the original Night Stalker before murdering for the last time in 1986. The two crime sprees were connected through DNA in 2001. However, it was the crime writer Michelle McNamara who gave him the new nickname of the Golden State Killer to reflect his reign of terror across California and to renew interest in the cold cases. 2 years after her passing, around the same time that her book about the case, I'll Be Gone in the Dark, was posthumously published, the rapist and murderer Joseph James DeAngelo was finally caught. DeAngelo's DNA was not on file in California or anywhere else, as he had never been convicted or even suspected of having committed a violent crime. Therefore, his DNA had never been collected. In fact, from 1976 to 1979, while he was active as the East Area Rapist, DeAngelo served as a police officer in Auburn, California. He had also been a police officer in Exeter from 1973 to 1976 during the Visalia ransacker attacks. He, ironically, was fired from the Auburn police force in 1979 after being accused of shoplifting, hammer, and dog repellent spray. Really, people? This led to the crimes shifting to Southern California and his MO shifting to murder. At this point, no one seems to know for sure why he changed his hunting grounds, but the escalation of murder seems to be from frustration due to the combination of failures at two consecutive crime scenes where victims got away from him, and a growing lack of satisfaction with his current crimes. He committed murders in the Santa Barbara area from 1978 to 1981, and then took a break before killing his last known victim in 1986. It's unknown why he stopped raping and killing after such a prolific crime spree, or why any serial killer just goes dormant, really. As I said earlier, these cases were eventually linked through DNA in 2011. By 2018, basically 40 years later, the investigators still had no leads or suspects. Forensic genealogy was essentially used to identify the aging perpetrator. To identify DeAngelo, investigators created a family tree of the suspect based on his DNA and eliminated family members based on age, location, and other characteristics. Once authorities zeroed in on DeAngelo as their primary suspect, they placed him under surveillance and collected his DNA from a tissue he left in the trash. While he has not spoken about his crimes, at his trial, he did plead guilty in exchange for avoiding the death penalty. While this case was a success, it has raised issues about bioethics and forensic science that occur in forensic investigative genealogical searching, which include issues about genetic privacy, discrimination, and public safety concerns. Due in part to the privacy concerns, larger genetic databases like 23andMe and Ancestry.com have issued policies actively restricting search authorizations. Familial DNA searches have been banned in Maryland and Washington, D.C., and are highly regulated in other states. However, open-source databases like the one used to identify the Golden State Killer do not have the same safeguards. Since DeAngelo's arrest, over 150 suspects have been identified through genetic genealogy. In October 2014, 4 years before genetic genealogy was used in the Golden State Killer case, it was first used by the police of Phoenix, Arizona, who had two cold case murders that had occurred decades before along a bike path near the canal. In November 1992, Angela Brasso was raped, murdered, and dismembered. 10 months later, in September 1993, Melanie Bernis was raped and murdered near the previous scene. Semen was found in both cases, but the police had no leads as to the killer's identity. In October of 2014, this open case was referred to Colleen Fitzpatrick of Identifinders by Phoenix police detectives. This eventually led to the arrest of Brian Patrick Miller, also known as the Zombie Hunter. This case was the first time that forensic genetic genealogy had been used to clear a criminal investigation in North America, helping to set the precedent of the science that was used to capture Joseph James DeAngelo. Unlike previous DNA investigations, Fitzpatrick used existing DNA databases rather than massive public dragnets such as in the original Leicestershire, England case, to find relative matches. Fitzpatrick used YSTR profiles, also known as Y chromosome short tandem repeat markers. They're polymorphic DNA loci that contain a repeated nucleotide sequence that is located on the Y chromosome. So it's located in the DNA of biological males only. To trace the male lineage of the suspect using the Sorensen YSTR database, which was later purchased by Ancestry and has since been taken offline, Fitzpatrick discovered that the DNA profile likely came from a male lineage with the surname of Miller. She was able to take an initial suspect pool of 2,000 suspects and narrow it down to 5 men. This information was then cross-referenced with any Millers living near the Phoenix Canals. Police followed up this lead with the investigation of Brian Miller and arranged a subterfuge to obtain his DNA. There were the genetic and location proximity links to Miller, but despite the facts that Miller had a previous conviction of second-degree attempted murder for stabbing he had committed while he was a teenager, the investigating detective's impression was that he was a little weird, but probably innocent of the murders. Ironically, Miller was actually well-known to the police and friendly with them. Not because of any crimes, but because he moonlighted as a zombie hunter in area events. He was a local character celebrity from participating in the downtown Phoenix Zombie Walk, put on by the Arizona Hemophilia Association as a fundraiser. The event is a slow-paced zombie shuffle through downtown Phoenix, created to bring awareness and raise funds for those with the inherited bleeding disorder. Miller dressed up in a mask and a costume and carried a fake Gatling gun to hunt the zombies. He lived this character much of the time, even outside of the parades. He even drove a repurposed police car that matched his alter ego and was somewhat of a local celebrity. He turned out to be more famous when the detective was proven wrong and Miller's DNA came back as a match to the homicides. Miller really threw himself into cosplay and in raising his daughter. Maybe that's why he stopped killing. Or maybe he didn't. Miller was actually a suspect in several other crimes over the years. DNA definitively linked Miller to the Brasso and Burness crimes, though Miller continues to deny his involvement. His previous conviction as a teenager for second-degree attempted murder was also a stabbing. He was accused of assault in 2002, but was then acquitted due to self-defense because his accuser wasn't thought to be credible. He was also accused of an assault that occurred in 2000, but it was brought to the police after the statute of limitations had passed. That seems like a whole lot of knife-related coincidences surrounding Miller. Guess he wasn't as innocent as the detective thought. All these cases where the police don't suspect the murderer, or are looking at the wrong guy, or maybe just don't know where to look, are one thing. And then there's Lonnie Franklin Jr. After he had killed 11 women that the police knew of, at least 7 of whom were killed by a matching 25 caliber gun, one of his victims survived. She could describe his vehicle, which another witness had also described, and provide other details of her attack. And yet Franklin was never a suspect. There were no suspects. This was also Los Angeles, California, in the late 80s and early 90s. It was a bit of a racial hotbed, as increasing unemployment, drugs, gang activity, and violent crime were on the rise, especially in the poorer neighborhoods of Los Angeles. Police were not seen as allies or helpful in changing these facts of life and often contributed to the issues faced in these communities. You youngins can look up Rodney King and the 1992 Los Angeles riots on your own time. Basically, nobody seemed to be taking the deaths of at least 13 women. In just over a two-year period, 1983 to late 1985, seriously. Primarily, this was attributed to victims of the Southside Slayer being primarily poor, black, female, drug users, and sex workers. They were even nicknamed the Strawberry Murders, with strawberry being slang for someone who exchanges sex for drugs. They were considered public service homicides. Other than the women in the community, such as Margaret Prescott and other community activists, who held weekly protests outside of the LAPD's headquarters, no one seemed to care. The community actually knew very little about the killer among them. Almost two decades later, in 2003, Franklin was arrested and convicted of a felony, for which he was sentenced to probation. In 2004, while Franklin was still on supervised probation, a law was passed that required DNA to be collected from all felons and everyone arrested on certain specified charges. Franklin's DNA was never collected to be entered into the system. Franklin was still not a suspect. In 2008, Lonnie Franklin's son, Christopher Franklin, was arrested on a felony weapons charge. His DNA was collected according to the law. When his DNA was entered into the system, it triggered a partial match. The partial match and his age ruled him out as the suspect, but finally caused the police to look at his father as a suspect. The police went undercover to get Lonnie's DNA. An undercover police officer pretended to be a waiter in a local restaurant to collect dishes, silverware, glasses, and pizza crust from Lonnie's meal to obtain DNA. DNA from saliva on the pizza crust left on Lonnie's plate matched that of saliva on the victims. From 1984 to 2010, Franklin essentially got away with murder. Nobody was looking at him. The victims, mostly African-American sex workers and or drug addicts, were nobody's priority. We don't know if he really didn't kill more women during his supposed dormancy. Maybe he put a little bit more effort into hiding the bodies than just dropping them in an alley a couple blocks from his house. He was a sanitation worker for some time, and at least one of his victims was found in black garbage bags in a dumpster. Maybe he put more effort into disposing of other victims, or they weren't connected to the .45 caliber weapon he was known to use. As with many of these cases, we'll never have an accurate count of the victims. Lonnie Franklin Jr. was found dead in his prison cell on March 28, 2020, while he was sitting on death row for his crimes. If his son hadn't been arrested for a felony and had his DNA compared to that of the open cases, Lonnie Franklin Jr. may never have been caught. Familial DNA was also a key piece of evidence in arresting the BTK killer, Dennis Rader, but in a different way. Rader was desperate for attention and recognition, unlike D'Angelo, and he often communicated to the press and the police. After having been dormant for 13 years, Rader heard that a book was being written of his exploits, and he got excited. He began dreaming of killing again, and of taunting the police with his superiority. However, with the advances in technology that occurred during his hiatus, police now had the upper hand. In what has to be one of the stupidest moves ever, Rader, in one of his letter to the police, asked them if his writings, if put on a floppy disk, could be traced or not. He admonished them to be honest. I guess Rader had decided that handwriting was too much work, or he liked to be able to go back and easily edit his opuses before sending them. So the police responded to answer his question in a newspaper and posted in the Wichita Eagle, saying essentially, "Of course not. You could never do that. It's totally safe to use the disc." Please note my effort to control the sarcasm. On February 16, 2005, Raiders sent a floppy disk to Fox affiliate KSAS TV in Wichita, along with a letter, a gold necklace, and a copy of the cover of Rules of Prey by John Stanford. Random, but okay. The disc was purple, by the way. One of those little hard plastic Memrex discs that only held 1.44 megabytes of information. It's not really relevant, but I'm old and that amused me. The whole floppy disc thing amuses me when it doesn't make me want to bang my head against the nearest hard surface. Okay, up to the story. Police took the disc and then, of course, found metadata embedded in a Microsoft Word document that had been deleted from the used disc. But that was unknown to Raiders, still stored on the floppy disc. Okay, first rule, people. Nothing is ever really deleted in the computer world. The document's metadata contained the words Christ Lutheran Church, and the document was marked as last modified by Dennis. An internet search determined that a Dennis Rader was president of the church council. Okay, circumstantial, but more than enough for them to side-eye Rader. So investigators decided to drive by Rader's house, where they saw a black Jeep Cherokee, a vehicle that was already suspected by the police as belonging to their suspect, and was parked outside. The reason they suspected the black Jeep Cherokee was because Rader threw a little bitch fit when no one noticed a clue that he had previously left, so he contacted the police to tell them exactly when and where he left it, in the back of someone's truck in a Lowe's parking lot. So they were able to pinpoint his vehicle on the security tape. This was strong circumstantial evidence that Rader was their suspected serial killer, and the police were ready to arrest him, but it was decided they needed more direct evidence to detain him. This is where familial DNA comes in. So as not to tip Rader off, police instead obtained a warrant to test a pap smear taken from Rader's daughter at the Kansas State University Medical Clinic. DNA test showed a familial match between the pap smear and a sample from one of the victim's fingernails. This indicated that the killer was closely related to Rader's daughter and, combined with the other evidence, was enough for the police to then arrest Rader. I had thought they followed this up with obtaining Rader's own DNA from a discarded coffee cup, as I had alluded to in the last episode, but apparently I was mistaken. They went straight from her DNA to his arrest. In my mind, of course, I'm thinking, what if the DNA hadn't been a familial match? People have affairs. Could Rader have been falsely eliminated? Rader's daughter later said that she would have given her DNA if asked, though she understands why she wasn't. However, her privacy was still invaded, and she had not committed, nor was she suspected of having committed a crime. Could they have probable cause for her DNA just because her father was a suspect? This makes me feel some way. I wonder how I would feel in her case if my DNA was secretly subpoenaed for a case my father, my brother, or a relative was suspected in. I would, of course, want them caught, but it feels icky to not have a choice. Then again, as a former member of the U.S. Army, my DNA is already part of the federal records. The Department of Defense began systematically collecting DNA samples to identify remains of service members during the Gulf War. On October 17, 2023, they processed the department's 9 millionth DNA reference card. The Armed Forces Repository of Specimen Samples for the Identification of Remains contains a DNA reference specimen for all active duty and reserve service members and an automatic database to assist in their retrieval for human remains identification. I remember being told when my sample was collected that it would only be used for this purpose. Good intentions, I suppose. However, while the database was initially designed only to identify the remains of service members, The 2003 National Defense Authorization Act opened the repository for law enforcement purposes. And to make matters worse, refusing to give up a DNA sample to the repository is grounds for prosecution under Article 92 UCMJ, failure to obey a lawful general order, carrying a maximum punishment of a dishonorable discharge, confinement for 2 years, total forfeiture of pay and allowances, and reduction to the lowest enlisted grade. So, entry into the armed forces in the U.S. since the 1990s means that your DNA sample is automatically collected, you have no right to refuse, and no say in how that sample may be later used against you or any member of your family. I get it. I'm not a serial killer. Or other criminals, so why should I care? I guess I just don't like being lied to. I mean, I went through my FBI interview for my security clearance. I gave my fingerprints and participated in my background check. Fine. I knew what was happening. The state of Texas took my thumbprint when I got a driver's license. Again, fine. I was informed of the procedure. Nobody was going behind my back to get my DNA from my doctor without my knowledge, or taking my DNA that I was told would only be used to identify my body in the time of war and adding it to a federal database a decade later to identify criminals. In a time where companies are trying to get patents on our DNA and almost any right we have can be withdrawn in the light of patriotism, is personal privacy much more than an illusion at this point? So, I don't know what the answer is. I am glad these people were caught. I don't know that it saved anyone, but I guess justice was served. Where are you on the privacy versus the public issue? I also wanted to bring up that I had a comment requesting longer episodes. So far, these have been bite-sized, about a half hour each. Part of the length has been my concentration on just the facts, the science, but I can open that up a bit more and talk in more detail about the crimes and the perpetrators. Let me know if you have a preference either way or would like a mix of shorter and longer episodes. I'd love to hear from you on social media or email about DNA and profiling or any future topics you'd like to suggest. You can find me on Instagram or Patreon as Science of Murder. It can also be reached at scienceofmurder@gmail.com. If you haven't already, please like and subscribe to the podcast to continue learning about the science of murder. Please leave a review of this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcast provider, and encourage your accomplices, I mean friends, to learn along with us. Have a good day.